I wanted to make some comments around three themes in Levi-Strauss's paper. First of all, the general question of symbolic function and symbol. Secondly, which is arguably the most important aspect of Levi-Strauss's work, which is his grasp of the logic of relations. And thirdly, the very, very clear and precise conclusion to Levi-Strauss's paper, where he distinguishes a new theory, really, of the unconscious and separates that from what he redefines as preconscious in Psygnosis. So he offers a kind of research program for analytic work, which has been partly taken up in some parts of the world and not taken up at all in others. So let's just start with looking at the chant that Levi-Strauss talks about, and through reflecting on that, it'll also help us to gain a perspective on some of the questions that Boris has just raised in his talk. It's a chant which is introduced at moments of a difficulty in childbirth. Levi-Strauss thinks that different terms, different lexical terms, correspond with different elements of the body. And through a very detailed, very minute description of comings and goings, of details of physical space, details which he thinks provide a closer and closer oscillation between what's happening in the mythical landscape and what's happening in the physiological landscape, this will have a curative power and will allow what he calls a successful delivery to take place. Now, for him, it's a question then of a psychological manipulation which has effects on the body. And one of the things that strikes him, and that he notes a couple of times in the essay, is why is the description so detailed? Surely, he thinks, the main lines of force of the shamanistic encounter and journey are the important elements. Why are there so many little details about thresholds, entrances, exits, accessories? What would seem to be, perhaps, for those schooled in the arts of narrative, embellishments? Why? Now, in Levi-Strauss's interpretation of some of the lexical elements, these symbolize parts of the body, physical pain, spiritual powers, and so on. And at an early point in the essay, I'll just read you a couple of quotes, he argues, he says, "The sick woman accepts these mythical beings that are introduced by the shamanistic discourse. Or more accurately, she's never questioned their existence. What she does not accept are the incoherent and arbitrary pains, which are an alien element in her system, which the shaman, calling upon myth, will reintegrate within a whole where everything is meaningful." That's a problematic point that Henrietta brought out in her talk this morning, the idea that this is a coherent system. It doesn't seem to be that central, really, to Levi-Strauss's argument, but there's the idea that the physiological pains are being mapped onto a different kind of space, a space made up of representations, which he calls mythical. Now, it's giving, he thinks, a language to the patient, what anthropology used to call an idiom of distress, perhaps. And we could ask here what the difference would be in this preliminary stage of Levi-Strauss's model between the cure of the symptom, the introduction of this new vocabulary grafted onto the body, and the construction of a symptom itself. If you compare Freud's model, for example, of the construction of a hysterical symptom with Levi-Strauss's model of the cure of a symptom, you might find something very, very similar. So, question, what would the difference be between the one and the other? Why would one seem to have an effect of resolution, whereas the other would seem to have an effect of entrapment in a symptom? Now, Levi-Strauss, again, makes this very nice and neat distinction that in the shamanistic cure, it seems as if the patient receives a social myth which helps her individual symptoms, whereas in psychoanalysis, the patient constructs an individual myth. So there's a difference between what you receive and what you construct. And now we come to really the crucial point in the paper. Levi-Strauss is saying that the basic condition, I'll quote, remains that the manipulation carried out by the shaman is carried out through symbols, that is, and here we have a first definition, meaningful equivalents of things meant which belong to another order of reality. Now, what are things meant and what is another order of reality? Now, on a very obvious level, you could say, well, the other order of reality is the order of mythical beings and representations. Whether we take the content of that order of reality seriously or not, or choose to reinterpret it, I think the key point here is the fact that what Levi-Strauss is getting at is simply that there is a reference to another order, that there are the pains creating the turbulence in the body, and then there is an appeal to another order. It's just that. Very, 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 very simple. And in that sense, you could say that it doesn't really matter if what the shaman says is meaningless to the patient. And again, I don't think no anthropologist would accept the concept of meaningless words. I don't think anyone would take that seriously. All these rituals are deeply embedded within contexts which are rich with meaning. If you can't understand the meaning of specific linguistic constructions, it doesn't mean that the constructions themselves don't convey different kinds of meaning. Isn't that, after all, the situation in which we're all born into? We're born into a world in which people are speaking around us, and it might take us a while to understand the meaning of particular words and sentences, but we know that different meanings are operative and functioning at different levels. There's no such thing as meaningless words. Yeah? As Gregory Bateson once said, the verb communicate doesn't have an opposite. Now, if we then go back to the question of the meaning of the shaman's words, in a sense you can say that with his reference to another order, Levi-Strauss has really grasped something about symbolic functioning. And the image that he evokes here, he moves away from psychoanalysis to what would have been called at the time. There was a lot of argument in the 50s about the validity of the work of Marguerite Sechaert. Some people were absolutely adamant that it wasn't psychoanalysis, that it was a form of kind of diluted psychotherapy. Other people gave it what they then saw as the dignity of an analytic process. There's the famous case that Sechaert describes in many of her works, of René, who also wrote an autobiographical account of her treatment, someone who had seen more than a dozen psychiatrists who'd been diagnosed at the time with having what would have been called then a chronic hallucinatory psychosis. It was someone who was really very, very unwell. And through a long work with Sechaert, there were changes. She became interested in biology. She did a degree. She became a biologist. According to her, her life was much more bearable and fruitful. And in her and in Sechaert's account of the cure, we read about the process of what they called symbolic realizations, what Levi-Strauss refers to, whereby Sechaert would take bits of apple, place them on her breast, and the patient would take them from her breast. And in one interpretation, you can say, well, you know, she's providing a loving environment to the patient and this is what helped her. For Sechaert, it's something much more specific, what she called symbolic realization, that the fragments of apple were symbolic of the maternal milk that she'd been deprived of as a child. She had a terrible history of gastric disturbance due to dilution of the milk. And the grandmother saved her, then the grandmother moved away, tragically, I think when she was 11 months old. She had a very, very difficult first year of life. And in René and Sechaert's conceptualization of the progress in their work, these elements stood for, were symbolic of the oral object of the breast, and gradually, through a long and piecemeal process, she was able to have the satisfaction that she'd been deprived of as a child. And crucially for Sechaert, the treatment was effective because the patient's trauma had occurred at what she called a pre-verbal period. Hence, the cure had to be pre-verbal in itself. Again, not categories that the analysts later on, or indeed Levi-Strauss, would accept. Levi-Strauss says something very, very interesting in his discussion, which you don't find anywhere in Sechaje. He says that what matters in the case is the fact that these moments, these bits of apple, and these moments of transaction between the two of them were differentiated. In other words, differentiated like the elements of language. And it's no accident, perhaps, that Sechaje and her husband had attended Saussure's lectures, the famous course on general linguistics, and their notes formed part of the text that was eventually published under that name. Now, another way of looking at it, if we take Levi-Strauss seriously about the differential aspect, is to say, well, you know, are these bits of apple really symbolic of the milk she was deprived of? Isn't what matters the fact that they're differentiated? Exactly what we see in the progression of the case, where first we have a little bit of apple that's cut, then we have baked apple, we have stewed apple, we have all these different kinds of apple, and we have more and more complex games of make-believe, letters from a dead rabbit to the patient, all things that are constructed around the ritual of the apple, but always preceded by the ritual exchange of an object. In other words, what you have is less the introduction of a new oral gratification to take the place of the missing milk than the grafting of a very, very elementary symbolic system, a grafting of make-believe, what we could call symbolic function, onto the patient, which then allows her to create more and more what Sechaje saw as imaginary elements, in which we could see, again, taking a perspective, let's say, of traditional psychology, not even psychoanalysis, as what allows the birth of symbolic functioning. Now, what is that? If you look at accounts today of what a symbol is, you'll find some very contradictory things, even in the authors who have paid a lot of attention to that. You find that, again, I'm schematizing, but some people say, well, you know, a symbol is a special part of language. Words are arbitrary. Everyone accepts that nowadays. But a symbol is different because there's something in the construction of a symbol which relays the actual structure of an empirical reality. In the sound, in the rhythm, the sequence of phonemes, a visual association, an acoustic association. The other people argue something which is exactly the opposite. And it's interesting that you have two totally, totally different interpretations here of what a symbol is. The others could argue that, on the contrary, what defines a symbol is precisely the absence of any link between the word and what it's supposed to refer. And this is exactly, really, the path that we find in the most elaborated study of symbol formation in the early years of psychoanalysis. Piaget, who trained as an analyst, he wrote a book called La Formation du Symbole in the 1940s. Sadly, when it was translated into English, they changed the title to Play, Dreams, and Imitation in Childhood. You'd probably sell more copies if you call your book that. But it's about the formation of the symbol. And in it, Piaget gives a beautiful example of his daughter, Jacqueline, who at a certain point invents an imaginary creature that she calls azo, which obviously resonates with oiseau, a bird, and she flaps her arms around in imitation of a bird. But very soon the azo becomes a dog, then it becomes an insect, and then it becomes lots and lots of different animals and creatures. The azo then starts to dispense justice. Azo will scold you if you do this. Azo makes jokes. Azo takes on a function in the family. So what we see is we track little Jacqueline's use of the word is that, crucially, what she's done, it's not just a study of language development. She's done something in a family. She's introduced a new character into the family system. Here's her azo, which first of all has the meaning of, let's say, the bird, and Piaget is obviously struck by the imitative quality of that, but then it becomes a dog, and then it becomes an insect, and then it can dispense justice, and so on. In other words, what we see is a word which would seem to have an initial bond to its imaginary referent. Little Jacqueline is flapping her arms like a bird. In other words, you have the idea of a resemblance or similarity that we index with the word like. But then it quickly moves to a whole chain of other signifieds. And then, when Azul has done its work, it disappears. And there's the idea then. This is where Piaget's observation is so useful for us, that he shows that the introduction of the word has a function in the family context, but it also, crucially, is systematically divorced from its original, apparently natural, imaginary referent. So we move from the imitative quality of the word to its autonomous symbolic functioning, where Azul matters in terms of its relation to a network of other terms in a system, no doubt an open, not a closed system. And when its work is done, it can go away. And we can say that this really introduces us to the psychoanalytic idea of symbolic functioning. In other words, a term that matters because of its emptiness. And we could say that in so-called child development, if the child does manage, and not all children do, to incorporate language and use it, you will always find a point in the first 4 years of life where there's the emergence of a linguistic entity, whether it's an animate one or an inanimate one, that's characterized by its difference from other elements and, crucially, by its non-connection to a referent. Another case right here in the Anna Freud Center, many years ago, Annelise Schnurman, as a child analyst, presented a case in a seminar of little Sandy, who had a dog phobia. It's a kind of famous case if you're interested in phobia. And at the moment that the phobia moves along, Sandy is managing to deal with some of her anxieties, Sandy picks up a little plastic dog and says, "Pussycat." And this coincides exactly with the clinical progression in the symptomology. Anna Freud was sitting at the table during the presentation and said that, because they couldn't understand why the kid had said that the dog was a pussycat, that the pussycat must mean the good side to a dog. Now, if you take, let's say, a more Levi-Straussian perspective, what little Sandy had done was exactly what Piaget's daughter had done and what Levi-Strauss, the patient in the ritual, had done, is to show the inscription of symbolic functioning within the organism. In other words, by referencing the fact that the word is separate from its imaginary meaning, that a word functions autonomously, and that a dog can also be a cat, just as we all know, a dog doesn't have to go woof woof, but can go meow meow in a child's games. It shows that a child has understood something about symbolic functioning. Now, I don't have time to talk about a case, do I? How much time have I got?
Do you want to take questions after, or do you want to wait till you have until roughly 5 after 10?
All right, okay. Let me just very, very briefly, I'll talk very schematically about the example, then you can follow it up yourselves if you're interested. Klein made a very important distinction between symbols and symbolic equations, which again, you need to think about it in order to go beyond the platitudes about symbols that you often hear nowadays. A lot of you must have had to provide a urine sample at some point. What happens when you do a urine sample? You go to your GP and they send you off to the loo and they give you a little bottle. What happens if you can't pee? Everyone knows what you do is you turn the tap on. Now, what's that? Is the tap a symbol? Yeah. Is there a correlation between the mechanics of the tap and the flow of water and what's happening with your own urethra? Yeah. Is that analogy to or homology to the Levi-Straussian process. Is the tap a symbol, a representation? How would one, what would be this, the sophisticated conceptual vocabulary? In Klein's terms, it wouldn't be a symbol, it would be a symbolic equation necessary for a child's progress, but catastrophic if it doesn't move further than that. So in Klein's idea, and Lacan as well, there's nothing inherently interesting about the world for a child. You see this with some autistic children where they don't register differences in the space around them or in the visual field. Comings and goings seem to have no impact. You wave a toy, there's no registration with some kids. Now, something has to happen to make the world interesting and differentiated. In Klein's theory, it's because primitive anxieties are equated with, not symbolized by, but equated with the outside world. So a tap could become, for example, a terrifying mouth that might devour the child. Yeah? Klein's idea is that the more of these symbolic connections that are made, the more spread out and extended the web of symbolic equations will become, and that will, through its very process, attenuate the child's anxiety. Other operations happen as well, but there's this basic idea that the more that symbolic equations are networked, the more that the anxiety will be mitigated. Yeah? Now, we're not talking about symbols, we're talking about a symbolic equation where one thing equals something else, and you can imagine that for some children who aren't able to move beyond that, the world is a terrifying place where a broken window is literally a hole in the body, or a running tap is literally their inside going out, which is what you see in some children and in some adults as well. That it's not that something symbolizes something else, but that it is. So, to move beyond this, something has to happen. Again, there are different theories in Klein and in Lacan about what has to happen. In Klein's case, I think which gives the finest illustration of that, called the A Study of Intellectual Inhibition from 1931, which is reprinted in Love, Guilt, and Reparation. The kid at the start of the case has this symptom, you think it's a strange symptom, that he can't distinguish between certain words and their translations, with the French words poulet, poisson, and glace, chicken, fish, and ice cream. He always associates each word with an erroneous meaning. Now, you've got to say, if a kid can do that, they're pretty smart. If they can always, out of a limited set of three words, get the wrong answer, they must know exactly what the words mean. Yeah? You can also wonder why someone's going to see Klein with that as a symptom. Now, without going into the details of the case, basically, she gets the associations. She finds that all these terms are laden with meaning. There's loads and loads of meaning. Yeah. So, for example, chicken makes him think of a chicken going in a chicken house and a fox going to attack the chicken. She thinks the child is like the fox, the newborn younger brother is like the chicken. So there's all these family themes, you know, that Klein would have loved about, you know, violence between, you know, family members and so on, and devouring and so on. And each of these words, chicken, fish, ice and so on, is linked to a particular meaning which seems to be, you know, anxiety-provoking, sometimes even generating agitation in the child's body. Now, various things happen. The child has an important dream. After Klein's elicited the associations, the child has a dream that the fish, that had been rather frightening, the fish was a crab standing on a pier on the seaside, etc., etc., etc. Klein makes interpretation in terms of the father's penis and so on. Then the child introduces a new term to the series, which is a version of the father's name. And then suddenly, and again, this is a sequence that lasts for a while, but the child is able to distinguish the words. No doubt the family are very happy. And now, the child says, this is the kind of the end of the treatment, the initial words, the differentiation of which had seemed so difficult, now he says, I know they're all the same, the chicken, the ice, the glass, and the crabs. He's introduced a new term, remember, to the series, which is crabs. The things that he couldn't distinguish between, he now says that they're all the same. And what's very interesting is that Klein thinks that this statement at the end of the treatment, that all these terms are the same, is a reflection of the initial symptom picture. The child couldn't link the words and the meanings because the words were all the same, because for her they were all linked to themes of injury and death. But why not, again, following Levi-Strauss and his linguistic orientation, see the statement at the end of the treatment as precisely a conclusion? The child can now use language in a more operative way, not because the words aren't all the same, but precisely because they are all the same. In other words, they're now all situated as linguistic elements in a chain, rather than as being words which are saturated, heavily saturated by meaning. If you can't dissociate the idea of a chicken from the idea of being devoured, it might be difficult to manipulate the word chicken. Yeah? But once you can empty a word of its imaginary and terrifying connotations, just as Piaget's daughter emptied the word azur of its connections with a bird flapping its wings, once the child can learn to separate the sign from the meaning, then the symbolic functioning can operate. And so you can read the child's statement that things are now okay because he's realized that all the words are the same. It's precisely a kind of access to linguistic functioning in which all words have got the same value, rather than each word being made massively different because of its connotations. In other words, what the symbolic function has done is to break the link with the imaginary referent. Just as Piaget's daughter creates the azur, Sandy in Annelise Schnurman's clinic creates the dog that's a pussycat, and one could think of, I'm sure, plenty of other examples. So, that's the first thing about the Levi-Strauss paper. I'll go very quickly through the other two. The logic of relations. Now, I asked Levi-Strauss several times, where did he get his understanding of the logic of relations from? And he said that it was in New York in the 1940s, and he'd been working on the question of marriage and kinship, and he knew that it needed a mathematical treatment, but he didn't have the tools. So he went to André Weil, who was a very prominent mathematician, and said, look, you know, he needs help with the question of formulating marriage with a mathematical model. Can you help? And Weil said he had absolutely no interest in marriage, but he did have an interest in the relations between marriages. Isn't that a gorgeous answer? And introduced Levi-Strauss to, according to him, the logic of relations, which is exactly what you find in his book, The Elementary Structures of Kinship, and exactly what you find at the end of this article. Remember, if you want to make sense of Levi-Strauss's argument as to why the incantation works, why does it have an effect, we have to remember, we have to differentiate that from the model of the urine sample. It's not turning on a tap that makes you wee. Something different is happening here. Exactly the introduction of what he calls another order of reality can be an order of anything you want as long as it's something different. And Levi-Strauss says towards the end of the article, and to me this is really the crucial thing that he learnt by, in a way, fusing Weil's interest in the logic of relations with what he'd learnt from Russian formalism. Levi-Strauss says, the organic transformation of the woman in childbirth is operated through a structural reorganization, yeah, by inducing the patient to live out a myth, received or created, whose structure would be analogous to the structure whose genesis is thought on the organic level. So two different things which share the same structure. The effectiveness of symbols would consist in this inductive property, a mathematical reference, by which formally homologous structures built out of different materials at different levels are related to one another. Exactly what we find elaborated in a way more clearly in the 1955 paper a few years later on the structural study of myth, where Levi-Strauss, you know, comes up with this amazing, amazing model of myth that Lacan then tried to apply to neurosis and kind of gave up with the idea that a myth isn't a solution to fundamental human problems, but rather it's a way of reformulating one impossibility in terms of another impossibility. Let me give an example. I mean, basically, this is crucial as a clinical strategy. Levi-Strauss's idea, this is what the Russian formalists thought. And let's start with something Freud that everyone knows. So, for Freud, as we grow up, we have to deal with certain things that are impossible to think. Where do babies come from? Why do we and our loved ones die? What are our bodies as sexualized? Things like that. Horrible, difficult things for children to try to think through. Obviously, some construct ways of thinking about it and some don't. But crucial for Freud, these are impossible things to think about. Now, then go to Russian formalism. Russian formalism says, some of it says, when something can't be formulated as a meaningful declarative proposition, it will take the form of a relation between propositions. In other words, if something can't be said, it will take the form of a relation between two other things that can be said. I'll give you an example. Let's imagine that it's impossible to think for a little boy that they might kill their dad. Well, what can you do? Why not make up not one story, but two stories, one in which a son goes onto an island to kill a minotaur inside a maze, and then on the way home forget to change the colour of their sail on their ship, which means that their father will think their son has died and jump off a cliff. In one fragment or in one thread of the story, you have a son deliberately killing a creature that isn't human, that isn't kin-related. And in the other strand of the story, you have a son accidentally killing a creature that is kin-related, their father, because he's effectively killed his father by forgetting to change the colour of the sail. Yeah? So, that's my kind of potted Levi-Straussian reading of the Minotaur story, just to bring out this idea that if something can't be formulated as a proposition, you know, the unconscious isn't the sort of thing which says, you know, I want to kill dad, I want to sleep with mum. Rather, it's a kind of combinatorial system producing threads of mutual contradiction, where the contradiction is ciphered in the relation between the two stories. Yeah? So we move from Freud to Russian formalism and now to Levi-Strauss with the idea that what matters in this example is precisely the putting into relation of two different sets of impossibilities, two different things that are too much to bear or that can't be thought by the human. And it's in that very putting together into a relation that things can move on. So he's not saying, Levi-Strauss isn't saying that the story cures the patient. He's just saying that there's a if you set two things in relation to each other, it's that process itself which has the dynamic effect. Finally, the preconscious and the unconscious. I mean, you know, what he says is still totally, you know, radical today. The unconscious as a kind of empty structure, like a stomach, and all the different things, the adventures, the misadventures, the tragedies, the joys of your lives are just like things passing through it that are organized by its laws. what matters is the study of the structural functions rather than what's inside. You know, it's a radical idea that, that Lacan took really quite directly from Levi-Strauss. And just to conclude, I mean, you know, you can't help seeing all this Bond stuff nowadays. You know, there's posters everywhere. This is what the children are talking about. There's endless stuff in the media. You know, even in the serious newspapers, they actually have serious journalists writing articles, who will be the next Bond. I mean, you know, what's that? I mean, again, it shows the Levi-Strauss idea, differentiating the preconscious and the unconscious structural law. To say who will be the next Bond implies that Bond is an empty place. It's a structural function which you have to step into. So anyone can go into that place. Yeah, the guy at the moment looks like he's worrying about his mortgage all the time. But the next guy could be much less, you know, concerned about things. You know, who knows? All that matters is that it's an empty place. And the concept of the next Bond shows this idea that Levi-Strauss alludes to in the penultimate paragraph, that ultimately all the different fantasies that people have that come out through analysis can be reduced to a few characters and a few elementary functions. Yeah, Q. What is Q? Q, do you remember, if you've seen the films, Q is the guy that, when Bond's about to go off and kill people who aren't white, generally, he's given something that will help him to kill them. Like, you know, some sort of a watch that has a gun or a car that can shoot torpedoes. Think back to stories of Greek mythology. When people go to kill other people or to kill monsters, they always meet with someone along the way who will either give them or from whom they will steal some magical objects, which they then use to accomplish their mission. It's exactly the same. Q now, and let's say the three ladies who give Perseus the magic cloak, the winged slippers, and so on. It's the what Propp calls the donor function, and anthropologists and folklorists have studied and tried to categorize and classify these different functions of mythology and folktale. You can limit these to a discrete finite set. Yeah. For Levi-Strauss, there's symbolic function. Everything else that happens, very interesting. And that what the process of an analytic work might consist of is to bring out the points of separation, inconsistency, incoherence, exactly the points where the symbolic function and the trajectory of the individual life fail to work smoothly together. Points where the symbolic, let's say, its function fractures. I'll stop that.
Thank you very much, Darren. Did you want to take a few questions before lunch? We have time.
If we've got time, 5 minutes, yeah.
Great, okay. Does anybody have any questions?
I'd like to return back to the idea of the patient receiving a myth in the fact that he doesn't know the words of the shaman being spoken. And I'd like to just question about a case in which the shaman would not know the meaning of his words in the point of ritual. Perhaps in the case of an invocation of a plant or animal spirit, and what that means in the role of the shaman.
Yeah, I think it's largely irrelevant. I mean, as a question of symbolic function, I mean, the study of how these things work in different cultures is obviously a separate question. You know, it's very interesting to think about what relation do people have to you know, rituals and what's spoken. But I mean, why do we always, you know, say, well, do they know the meaning of words? I mean, do we know the meaning of words when we speak? You know, isn't psychoanalysis about trying to make people realize that actually they don't in their own culture? You know? If you go to, you know, see a consultant in the NHS and they tell you what your problem is, you know, do you really understand their language? Do they really understand some of the words that they use? We might, but, you know, how effective are these things? when we actually know a bit more about it. You could argue that some of these processes work better the less people know about the words. But I think the point I was making earlier is that symbolic functioning, you have to separate the sign or the signifier from the meaning. It has to be cut. But at the same time, there's no such thing as a meaningless discourse. You can't, I mean, linguists have shown years ago, you can't separate syntax from semantics. You can't, it's not, you know, Chomsky has his famous colorless green ideas sleep furiously until someone found an almost identical line in a 17th century poem, you know, which people have been writing about in, you know, post-Renaissance studies for years, you know, without being aware of Chomsky. So you can't convey anything without conveying something. You know, as I quoted Bateson earlier, the communicate doesn't have an opposite. Yeah. There's no such thing as words without meaning, even if you're not aware of the lexical meaning.
Thank you. Maybe one more?
There's a question here.
If you are conveying something, it can be wordless. I was 15 years old. I came to this country. I'm just giving an example. I was asked by the family I was staying with whether I would want to go to midnight mass. Now, I didn't know anything about midnight mass when I came. I went in there, and it was Canterbury Cathedral, and there were choir boys singing. I've never experienced choir boys. Mm. And there was something about being in this incredible space and the sound of the choristers. I just found myself crying. I didn't know why. I had no words. There was something beyond words that moved me. It wasn't even, I couldn't even say it was tears of sadness or tears of what, but it was an experience. I'm coming back to the shaman. In a way, is it something about, and also psychoanalysis, is it something about the experience of the sound and the experience of the
this would be exactly what Levi-Strauss and the analysts inspired by him would disagree with, in that you might find during the analytic process, you might find out more about why you cried. Yeah. Who knows? You know, that's your own question. But the key is that any serious analytic theory has to dispense with a brute notion of experience. I mean, it's why Bion's work doesn't really go very far, because he ultimately goes back to an idea that everything is just based on building blocks of experience. Without the subtlety of Levi-Strauss, and, you know, something that the anthropologists know about, and hopefully analysts can learn from them, that what we take to be our everyday realities and moments of pure experience are actually massively structured by networks of representations, failures of representations, but thing, you know, by systems, by culture, by discourse.
Very, very nice place to end, I think. And so we'll break for lunch and be back here to begin again at 2:15. Thank you.